And the words I speak and the words we hear be your words of life to us, our God. Amen. Last week we spent some time in Mark hearing this story set in Caesarea Philippi, where this photo is taken. A place where the Greeks, who had conquered the world under Alexander the Great, had built a temple to Pan. And then, so this is what this area is about. And then Philip had built a city honouring Caesar and their generals, the Caesars and their generals, who had also conquered the world through military might, through the use of force and violence. And near this place, Jesus had asked, who do people say that I am? And then he asked, who do you say that I am? And Peter said, the Messiah. But really, we would assume that Peter really wanted Jesus to be like Alexander or a Caesar. And Jesus responds by teaching that he indeed will not be like that. He will be crucified. To which Peter takes him out and rebukes him. And we have the next part of the conversation between Jesus and Peter. We can summarize what Jesus was talking about by saying that the way of God was not the way of violence. It was not the way of military force and power. It was the way of aroha, the way of love. Or, as Jesus himself says later in all of the Gospels, to love the Lord our God with all our heart and soul and mind by loving our neighbours as ourselves. This way is very disruptive of the world's powers. And the world's powers will respond to this way. And Jesus will be crucified. Jesus goes on to say, all who want to come after me must say no to themselves, take up their cross and follow me. All who want to save their lives will lose them. But all who lose their lives because of me and because of the good news will save them. Why would people gain the whole world but lose their lives in this place built to honour those who had gained the whole world? And then we told some stories about those in this land and overseas who have lived the way of love, God's disruptive way, have stood with the suffering. And we finished by talking about Archbishop Janani Luang from Uganda, who was executed on Idi Amin's orders in 1977 for protesting against the human rights abuses that were going on in that country. And it all felt quite big, didn't it? This carrying your cross. Well, I went home and I was listening to a book by an African-American black theologian, in fact, the father of black liberation theology, James Cone, and he's written a whole lot of books. I've read a few of them, and the book I'm reading at the moment is a biography looking at the lives of Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, who most people think were at polar opposites, and increasingly today people are saying they were very similar in what they were looking for. And in this book, so I'm right at the beginning, and I'll read a bit more this afternoon. He was talking about Martin's experience of growing up in the South, his experience of the appalling racism in the South, and the power of the church, particularly the black church, to provide shelter as a place of resistance to Jim Crow and its insistence that Negroes were nobody. Cone writes, God, African-American churches claimed, could make the crooked roads straight and the rough places plain. They believed that God builds you up when you are torn down and props you up on every leaning side, no matter what white said about you, no matter what white said about blacks, or what wicked laws they enacted against their humanity. The people of Ebenezer Baptist believed that God had bestowed upon them a somebodiness, which had been signed and sealed by Jesus' death and resurrection. That was why they sang with great enthusiasm and prayed with much thankfulness for what the Lord had done for them. Somebodiness. That made me rethink what taking up the cross might be. Faith. as resistance to inhumanity. It turns out somebodyness is very disruptive. To live somebodyness is dangerous. Martin told stories about his father, Daddy King, and how he would not bow to the inhumanity of Jim Crow. One story he told was when he was in the car with his father and they were stopped by a white policeman who said, "Boy, show me your license." To which Daddy King responded, pointing at Martin, "He is a boy. I am a man." Somebodyness. But that was dangerous. He could have been beaten. Could have been arrested. Could have been lynched. As thousands were. And so Martin grew up in the South knowing how to look, how to behave. Took him a while. It was a shock at first when he encountered racism, when he wasn't allowed into his friend's house because his friend was white and he was coloured. And in fact, their friendship had to end because his father would have none of that nonsense. And he was slapped around the head because he'd accidentally, so the woman said, had stood on her foot. In 1955, Emmett Till was down in Mississippi from Chicago, where he lived with his family, and he had not grown up in the South, and he did not know how to behave, little 14-year-old boy. And he was accused of looking at a white woman wrong. And so a group came to where he was staying, and they took him out, and they beat him, and they tortured him, and they lynched him. Being somebody is dangerous. His mother refused to have a lid on his casket back in Chicago, and there were thousands at that funeral, and it was broadcast live. She wanted the world to see what Jim Crow looked like and what it had done to her son. A little bit later that year, Rosa Parks, motivated in part by that death, refused to leave her seat. And a young Baptist preacher who had only just gone to Montgomery ended up in the public limelight, Martin Luther King. To be somebody is dangerous when everyone around you says you are nobody. And so people who carry the cross are often just living the truth that they are somebody, that they are made in the image of God. So I wonder where in this country and where around the world there are people today who are seeking to live their somebodyness when those all around them are saying they are nobody. And as we think about that, we are given two interesting texts. I'm ignoring Paul. Not because I don't like Paul, but, you know, there's morning tea. So Paul loses out again. So as I said, we have this passage from Exodus. It's the Decalogue, the 10 words, the 10 commandments, which are given to the people of God after they have been freed from slavery. So I don't know how you normally read them, whether you read them as rules that we have to obey so we don't get yelled at by God, or rules that we have to obey so that God will give us a reward. But for these people, they'd already been given their reward. They were free, they were somebody, and they were living in the wilderness with God right there in their midst. Pillar of fire during the night, pillar of cloud during the day, leading them through the wilderness. You can't get any more treats than that. They are somebody, and God is in their midst. But what does it mean? And they had done nothing to deserve that. Nothing. They were just slaves in Egypt. And God had heard their cry and had remembered that covenant that we heard about last week from Genesis 17, that eternal covenant. And God was faithful to that covenant, and God had brought them out of Egypt. And so this undeserved, this generosity, this compassion shone towards them. And here they were living. What does it mean to live in response to this compassionate and generous God? What does it mean to live with God in your midst? That's what the Ten Commandments are. How to live with God in your midst. But they were not to be just anybody. As we talked about last week, when looking at Genesis 17, there was a restatement of the covenant from Genesis 15 and Genesis 12, which can be summarized with the words, blessed to be a blessing. They weren't just blessed for themselves. They were blessed to be a blessing. They were to be different from everyone else around them. They were to live God's compassion and generosity. They were to be marked by this compassion and generosity, so the world could look at them and see what it was that God wanted for all creation. So the Ten Commandments acted in this way. And as they lived in the wilderness, and as they lived trying to grapple with what it meant to be sons and daughters of God, I couldn't find one which was kind of slightly less sexist, but just go with that one. Much rather if that said to children of God, but never mind, because I'm pretty sure the women were also free, to some degree. While they lived in the desert, they had to learn to rely on God. So at the heart of the Ten Commandments, at the heart of the Ten Words, is this understanding that God will provide. And God does provide in the wilderness. Water from the rock, manna, and the birds. They are fed, they are kept alive. And because God will provide, well, that should change how they live. They don't need to be constantly grasping, trying to conquer the world, because God will provide. Just as the Lord's Prayer teaches us. So, the Ten Words help them and us think about what it means to be somebody marked by God's generosity and compassion, knowing that God will provide. Which leads us to our last story, the story of Jesus cleansing the temple. Now, we know the story. We know it well. And we hear it probably every year. And we usually hear it from the Synoptic Gospels. And the Synoptic story is different. So the first thing that's different about it is Matthew, Mark, and Luke put the story right at the end. It's one of the last things he does after Palm Sunday. It's the thing that gets right up the nose of the Jewish leaders, and they decide that he has to die. But this story is right at the beginning. All Jesus has done so far is obey his mother and turn water to wine. And then he goes to Jerusalem for Passover, like a good Jew, because he is a good, devout Jew. We need to remember that. And he goes into the temple. And while John kind of says he cleans out all the cattle and the sheep and he gets rid of all the money changers and everyone else, if that had really happened, John wouldn't have needed to write the rest of his gospel, because at that point, the temple guards and the Romans would have dealt to him. They were not going to put up that kind of nonsense, especially at Passover. He would have been whisked away and never heard of again. Gone. So this was if John's version is right, this is a very small, localized little fracas. And he can get out of there pretty quick. Now this is a dangerous story, because it's often read as Jesus saying that he supersedes the temple. And Christians read that to mean that then Christianity supersedes Judaism. And then that has been used to justify all sorts of horrific acts by Christians against Jews. So we have to be very careful with the story and what Jesus says here. So we need to remember that when John wrote this, This is long after the temple has gone. Long after. In 70 AD, Jerusalem falls. The city is destroyed. The temple is destroyed. So by the time John is writing, there is no temple. So John is not writing in a time where there is a temple and Jesus is saying he's going to replace the temple. He is writing in a time when his Jewish Christian church is dealing with the reality that there is no temple. And for Jewish Christians, as well as Jews, the temple had been the center of their life. It had been the place where God was to be found. The presence of God. The presence of God, which had been in the clouds, and then was in the Ark of the Covenant, and then in the tent of meeting in the Ark of the Covenant, and then when Solomon built the temple in the Holy of Holies in the Ark of the Covenant. The temple represented God present here on earth. But it's gone. The temple, which reminded those people that they were somebody marked by God's generosity and compassion and were to live differently from everyone else. But it was gone. So where then is the center? And so, as John says, after Jesus is risen, and he doesn't say this bit, but after the fall of the temple, John and his community remember, and they reinterpret the stories, and we get the story today. And the question then is, where is God to be found? And John's answer is, in Jesus. Jesus. So Jesus becomes the somebody. The somebody. The one that we look at to see what it means to be somebody. We look to Jesus. But he's more than that. John is saying he is much more than that. He is not just the somebody who shows us how to live God's compassion and generosity. He is saying he is God's compassion and generosity in flesh. That's a much bigger thing. It doesn't sound like a much bigger thing, but it is a much bigger thing. He is God. God's compassion, God's generosity, God's love in flesh. And I think he goes on to say that because of the crucifixion and because of the resurrection and through the ascension and the power of the Spirit, you and I are also God's compassion and generosity in flesh. We aren't just somebody. We aren't just made in the image of God. We are God enfleshed here and now through the work of the Spirit. Now that sounds a bit spooky for us in the West. Actually, the Orthodox Church has always believed that. Always proclaimed our divinity. And so whenever I pour water into the wine at the beginning of the Eucharist, I pray this prayer. As this water mingles with this wine, so may your divinity mingle with our humanity, and your humanity mingle with our divinity, that we may be drawn into the eternal dance of love, which is the Trinity, and be icons of your compassion, your generosity, your justice. So we are somebody, but more than that, we are God's somebody, enfleshing God's compassion and generosity. And that will invite opposition, if we live it. Just as it invites opposition for many people around the world today, living, being somebody, God's somebodyness. That's a great word, somebodyness. And that can be tough and hard. So we need to remember, as we do that, going back to the story of the Decalogue, that we do that because we trust that God will provide. So that's something for us at Lent, how we hold all of this together, being somebody and trusting God. So as we think about that, I want to finish with this little piece from the St. George's College Pilgrimage in the Wilderness series. Well, it's not a series, it's one video. You can find that on our Facebook page. The guy talking last week, we had Dean Richard. Today it's Rodney Ace, the Reverend Dr. Rodney, as the course director, so he does all the teaching. He's a wealth of knowledge, as you will find out. So he is talking about the Palestinian monks. So these are the monks from the early church, and he's deliberately using that word, Palestinian monks. So these are people who have... I remember George Connor once saying, after he'd been to St. George's, he was talking to some Palestinians, and he asked them, "When did your family first become Christians?" And the response was, "Oh, sometime around the day of Pentecost." And George Guy, who's of good Irish stock, "Oh, I'd hate to think what my family were doing around the day of Pentecost, probably off raiding somewhere." So these monks who lived in the wilderness between the Jordan Valley and Jerusalem, which, as we heard last week from Dean Richard, was quite a busy place at the height of the Byzantine era, which is the kind of 600s, 700s, 800s.